And then we're off. Wow. That's good. Let me see. For advancing slides. Great. Let me make sure you can hear me okay. I'll be speaking today on behalf of a very large group. Dr. Lee, I think she's around. I'm not sure, but she may walk in. She's been a collaborator on this project for a long time. Good News Project has been around for a long time, as you see. And I'm just happy to be here and present some of this to you. Our work is funded by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the NIH, and also it's currently funded, the continuation of it is the National Institute for Minority Health and Health Disparities, NIMHD. And the reason we've been able to generate some strong interest in our work is that heart attack and fatal coronary disease, especially among African Americans, continues to grow at epidemic levels. If you look at this graph right here, top two lines represent African American men and women. And then if you look, health inequalities among African Americans, heart disease death rates 30% higher, stroke 50% higher, death rate for diabetes is 100% higher than whites. And in the communities where we've been working, this leads to kind of a fatalism about health where people really don't know what to do about it. And the kind of social determinants of health approach we use really addresses this conclusion from the CDC and the World Health Organization that 80% of these chronic diseases, especially cardiovascular, are preventable. And then the objective and what we've been trying to do for about the last 20 years is to figure out, well, if they're preventable, how can you really prevent them? And that's really been the basis of our work. We know from just early pioneer studies, and still true today, that heart disease is the leading cause of death among Americans. But when we look behind the scenes, we see that lifestyle factors related to tobacco, diet activity, alcohol are really the primary culprits here. Although cardiovascular or heart attack may appear on the death certificate, what's really going on is behind the scenes is much larger than that. And I always like to fool my first-year medical students by asking them, what contribution is healthcare to premature mortality? They think it's 90%. And I show them a slide like this. It says, well, no, healthcare plays a role, but really, lifestyle, environment, and genetics, with lifestyle and environment playing the absolute biggest share. So what we've been doing is working since about 2000. Dr. Lee started this pioneering work back in, actually in North Carolina. And the work started probably about 1998, and we really started to do demonstration work around 2000. We did a feasibility study funded by the CDC, 2002-05, pilot and confirmatory studies with foundation funding in 2005-07, and then we did a cardiovascular disease prevention trial, 2007-2013. Had a great team, UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas is where I'm really from. We had a great team, the cardiology group there, the endocrine group, and the family medicine group, as well as clinical nutrition. And what we've been trying to do is push this model we've developed based on our work in Mexico and Peru and now in China that we call the community health science model, which is this idea of integrating clinical care and epidemiology with community partnerships and organizations. Public health is a big part of the solution, but the first thing that people tell me when I go into the community is, Dr. D, if you help me get a job, I promise I'll be a lot healthier. And so it's incumbent upon us to work very well with community organizations. The other thing is they generally tend to have some existing pathology. I mean, they really need an endocrinologist. They really need a heart doctor. And they really need primary care physicians. So our approach has been trying to knit this together. we look at any community health problem, community health problem is going to have folks already involved in trying to solve it at the community level. Public health is already going to be there, preventing disease in some capacity. Even the little teeny communities we go to in Mexico, medicine's going to be there, treating and diagnosing disease, and the mediating institutions are going to be there. Churches, schools, businesses, governments, CBOs, non-governmental organizations, everybody's there, but usually everybody's in their own little silo. So our community health science model that we've developed has been designed to try and bring all of that together, coordinate all of the existing things that everybody is doing, bring medicine, public health, and these organizations together. So this just gives you a little bit of a timeline about how we've done it in our work in South Dallas. We brought together, starting way back in 2002. Actually, we didn't bring together. They invited us. I was a medical school member of the South Fair Weed and Seed Pastors Coalition in South Dallas. I don't know if any of you remember the old Weed and Seed program, designed to go into communities and weed out the bad and seed the good. Well, the pastors were definitely trying to do the good, and I don't have too much to say about the bad. We were all just really trying to do good. And then what we did was, starting in 2004, we started to do actual study with 12 African-American congregations. 2007, we got some real good funding from the NIH to move it forward a little bit. We added the Departments of Internal Medicine and Cardiology, Endocrine, added public health capacity from Parkland Health and Hospital System, and then added 18 new African-American congregations. And for those of you who are wondering, I did not lead this. This was all started by the South Fair Weed and Seed Pastors Coalition, and then the 12 African-American congregations that started this. They're actually the ones that are still the core, still running it today, with very little input from me. So it's really been a community-driven organization. It's been a loose confederation, but it still works very well. So I want to talk a little bit about the Good News Trial itself, how we ran it, what we found. These are just some kind of typical pictures of what we might see, seen through my eyes, the eyes of a camera, and the eyes of the pastors that I work with. For those of you who are familiar with the role of the African-American church in inner-city communities, you know that it's a very important social institution that doesn't just isn't just preaching the Word of God on Sundays. It's doing a whole lot more than that. And in these areas we work, death rates due to heart disease and stroke, 2 to 3 times higher. This won't come as news to most of the people in this room. And higher than those in more affluent parts of the city. So this is tends to be a socioeconomic problem. So we work with congregations. Really fortunate to have some great congregations. The leader of our group in Dallas is Bishop J. Lee Slater, New Millennium Bible Fellowship, and it's also run by Pastor George King, Cities of Refuge Church. And what we were trying to do is this in our work. If you look at this diagram, what you see is a hospital at the top, medical technology, the arrow on the left, and then you see primary care located in the middle of the diagram, and then you see 3 different layers beneath that: a church health committee, lay health promoters, and the Good News community. Well, in the United States, generally you go into any community, if you're lucky you have primary care clinics, and then what happens is we wait for people to get sick and then they go to the hospital. Through our work in Mexico, where they don't have that much money to spend on treating all these diseases, they needed to decentralize, and the way they did it was this way right here. We worked with them from 2003 to 2008 to do that. So you have 3 additional layers. I'd love to talk more about the model and how we developed it, but I'll just leave you with this. In the United States, the amount of money we spend treating existing disease accounts for about 90%, 95% of our healthcare expenditures, and about 5% is devoted to prevention. In Mexico, they've had to flip it So they've worked this model so that now their care is 70% preventive and 30% treatment-oriented. And if your numbers fall below that, you're in danger of being fired. And the people who fire you are, guess who? It's not the medical system, it's the Community Health Committee. So the Community Health Committee is really designed to partner with the medical system. It's an astounding thing. Some of you may have heard about it. I spoke about it the other day at the student assembly, Oportunidades program. It's what our favorite politician, Michael Bloomberg, has tried to do in New York with not much success. So we train lay health promoters and congregations. Here's some great photos of our lay health promoters, our Good News lay health promoters. And this is kind of gives you an idea. The picture on the right is us doing measurement, and picture on the left is what a typical training seminar would look like for training lay health promoters. And then there's Dr. Lee in the middle of a bunch of folks at looks like a Christmas party. And what we were trying to do was this: test this CBPR lay health promoter approach and see if we could actually change behavior. Diet history questionnaire we measured, and also physical activity. We did a lot of other clinical measures, but I just wanted to talk about those two briefly. We focused on 18 new congregations, trained 2 lay health promoters in each of the congregations. They developed health ministries in collaboration with their pastors and other people of the church, recruited virtual wellness club members, people to participate in the programs they were developing. Congregations were randomized to a maintenance intervention or independent health ministries. And then we did measures at baseline 18 and 36 months. We used a pretty standard health education model. Coming more from a social determinants of health background and epi background. Dr. Lee's a health educator, and when she opened my eyes to this model, it was just voila. This is really the way to approach community work. And let me show you who we ended up working with. Baseline characteristics of our sample of 392 folks. Very interesting. High education. Mostly female, physically inactive, if you look at the light activity moderate. This is based on the 7-day PAR, the physical activity recall. Body mass index, as you can see, looking at weight classification, very large percentages, no surprises, of obese. That's pervasive in throughout the United States. It doesn't matter where you go. And it doesn't matter the racial ethnic group you're looking at. I think the thing that's most disturbing to me is metabolic syndrome. That is something that you don't see everywhere. And we see significant proportions, almost half of our group, metabolic syndrome. So we're at a high-risk group to begin with. This is what, have you been diagnosed with heart disease? You look at U.S. nationally, 6.1 for African-American adults. Our group was 9.3. High cholesterol, 14.5 versus 36.3. Type 2 diabetes, 11.8 versus our group, 15.3. And then, especially disturbing, diagnosed with high blood pressure. This was pretty darn tough. We do a lot of work around blood pressure. 31.6 versus half of our group having been diagnosed with high blood pressure. And a lot of times it's uncontrolled. And of course, high blood pressure, number one, cause 4 times more likely uncontrolled blood pressure to end up with renal failure over the life course. So it's especially disturbing. And this is what we were able to do. Looking all the way on the left, what we're really trying to do here is we're trying to get a group by time interaction. And as you can see, none of ours are significant. Group by time effects don't even come close discriminating between our two groups in this mixed effects model. But if you look at the time effect, there is a very significant time effect. Something happened here. And the thing that happened is in our intervention group, they really changed eating behavior. If you look to the middle column at 18 months and then the final group there at 36 months, those significant effects highlighted in yellow refer really to changes that occurred in our intervention group. So there was no difference between the two groups. In other words, no group by time effect. And that's essentially because both groups changed over time. And our group in the intervention changed significantly more. For people that do community-based work, this was very encouraging for us. I didn't want to see, tell you the truth, I didn't tell this to the NIH. Is anyone from the NIH here? But I just wanted to see everybody get a little better, to tell you the truth. My ultimate objective here was to try and improve health in the community, not get a significant effect on an intervention. It would have been nice from a funding perspective, but overall, I answer to a higher authority than that. So I was just glad to see that we really did some good. So program participants achieved significant reductions in calories and saturated fat. Calories declined 24%. Saturated fat declined 26%. You cannot measure the stroke that did not occur, but I am absolutely positive, prevented some strokes. So we're moving on. We're doing a new trial on obesity. Fortunate enough to get that funded, NIMHD. These are some pictures here from that activity that's just now starting and underway. Do this with a cast of thousands. Special thanks, though, to our pastors and lay health promoters and the congregations that have participated in our programs, wellness club members, and the others participating in the congregations who really have afforded me and our team the privilege of collaborating on some really meaningful work that I believe is making a difference. I don't have a slide up here. I was looking for it last night of the study team. They've all been great. But they're a cast of thousands also. As I say, we've got the entire cardiovascular group at Southwestern. We've got a cardiologist at the NIH. We've got folks from Tiffany's team, Nora Gimple, our family doc who's been collaborating with me since the very beginning, and of course Dr. Lee, whose efforts in this area have been heroic. So we're just especially grateful, though, for all these congregations. You can go check us out on the web if you'd like to, on the internet at goodnews-trueliving.com. All right, I know that was a lot to digest, but thank you for your attention, and I think we have a minute or two for a couple of questions, if anybody has anything, any clarification. Yes, way in the back.
Mark, can you clarify that you had a control group?
Yes.
And what was the control group
intervention? Yeah, good question. I know I glossed right over it. The control group, we trained the lay health promoters, and then they needed to be proactive themselves in working with us. What we were trying to do was most clinical trials say, okay, train somebody and then you go away. And our contention was, and this is the case we made to the NHLBI, look, the whole deal here is maintenance. It's not just training, educating people and then going away, it's training people and then staying there with them. So the purpose of the trial was really to demonstrate that we could train all lay health promoters in our 18 congregations, and then we did ongoing maintenance with 9 of them. The other ones were independent, and they needed to be proactive with us. They could call us. They could participate in events. We would give things, materials, giveaways when they had events. We would support them financially, but we were not going to pull them along as in the case of a clinical trial. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. Y'all know Cheryl Holt, Cheryl at Maryland. Cheryl, we're working up a project right now to begin looking at that, to try and understand a little bit more about the background features. So we're working on it. And it's a great question, really exploring what difference it makes. And it's really been something that Dr. Lee's been interested in. I'm really interested in it as well. And for a lot of different reasons, I think there's a faith effect. I think that, you know, given the power of the pastors in the community, I mean, we have such a hard time with human subjects with going for our IRB because they don't want to really allow us to do that. I mean, they didn't like the word good news. You know, you can't use good news, they told us, for a trial. The NIH told us that too, but we've resisted it because we're trying to make the work we do as much like life as possible. So the answer to your question is, I don't really know. We've not really looked at it, but it's something we're moving ahead with. Yes, right up here.
Yeah, you indicated that you had a model of seven dimensions of hell.
Yes.
And one of those is spiritual.
Yes.
Was there any direct intentional spiritual component? For example, prayer being directly a part of that and helping to prepare people.
Yeah, that's a good question, too. And do we have time? We have. Yeah, we'll have some time at the end. In Yannick's study, Y-A-N-E-K, what they found was you can't take in inner city African-American congregational community, you can't even take faith-based out if you want. And we've recently done focus groups, and people say, look, Dr. D, you know, if God isn't in the middle of this, we're not interested. Because that is the lifestyle, and that is the most important component of lifestyle. Our program focused, we did not put anything in. Ours was, we were the health educators. We were the clinicians. We were the health professionals. We're not the spiritual professionals. But working in the congregational setting, the pastors and lay health promoters automatically bring that. And when we would do challenges among our group, to promote health, spiritual health, you could get points in the challenge for reading your Bible, for attending a Bible study, things like that. So we acknowledge the reality of where we were. Good question. Better leave it there and get everybody else. Thanks a lot, everybody.